Well, good morning, anyhow. As you know, if you are staying with us, we'll be studying the Ten Commandments for the next few weeks. And in this early stage, we're reviewing what we learned last year, at least what I learned. For having begun in September a year ago, we were not able to finish because of time restraints. But I want to keep reminding myself and you of the awesome importance of these commandments, of how important it is to commit them to memory, of how important it is to rehearse them daily and often during each day, of how important it is to reflect on them, to think about them, and allow them to give divine direction to the way we live. So I've made up some little cards. It's labeled the Ten Commandments. That's probably a mislabeling of it, so you'll forgive me for that. But it's the essence of the Ten Commandments in verse form, and there are certain things about it that I'm not 100% happy with, but we'll change that as we go along. But nevertheless, I think it would be useful just to have these at hand. So if you just want to pass them along, we'll pass them out. Let me make sure David gets one up there. Thank you. And you can put them on your refrigerator door or on the windowsill above the sink where you do the dishes. No, that's right, you don't do dishes anymore. You put them in the dishwasher. Or on your desk or in your backpack or wherever it will be most visible to you as the constant reminder. So as we begin this morning, I'd like to give someone the opportunity to recite these commandments for us, not necessarily these, and certainly not to read them aloud, but if you know them by memory, I would like to give someone the opportunity to do that. Now, you don't have to. I'm not going to call on anyone. But is there anyone who would like to? Well, I don't see a flood of hands, so we'll let that go. I'd like to read the Ten Commandments, however, again for us, and would encourage you, encourage myself, to learn the commandments by heart so we know exactly what they are and can rehearse them to ourselves day by day. We'll read from Deuteronomy 5 this morning, and beginning at verse 6. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I am the Lord your God, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations. Actually, you'll notice, if you're reading the NIV, which I'm reading, that the word generations isn't in there. And I really think it should not be in there, but showing love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor the alien within your gates, so that your manservant and maidservant may rest as you do. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. Honor your father and your mother, as the Lord your God has commanded you, so that you may live long and that it may go well with you in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not commit murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not set your desire on your neighbor's house or land, his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. For better or worse, I actually think it is for better. I have been in the habit for years now to come home for lunch and lie down for 15 minutes and use this time to read a novel. And you know, it's incredible the number of novels I've been able to finish in this way. My wife thinks, how can you get involved in a novel and read it only for 15 minutes and then put it down? Well, I probably wouldn't read any if I didn't do something like that. Just last week, I finished George Eliot's Middlemarch, a magnificent book. And if you haven't read it, I certainly do recommend it. And I've begun a new one, given to me from the library of Lynn Hawthorne Loiseau, and by her, with her recommendation. It is entitled The Clan of the Cave Bear by Jean Auel. Anybody read that? I have. Somebody has. I understand there's even a movie about it. Well, having just begun this book, I hardly know what it's all about. Nothing really of its historical or geographical setting, or how it's going to develop, or even if I'll finish it. You know, if I get into a novel and I don't like it, I'll put it aside. I haven't even gotten that far yet to know whether I will like it. But one passage early on in the book caught my attention, especially as I've had the Ten Commandments on my mind. It goes like this. Brun, the leader of this strange clan of people, turned away from the river and led his clan toward the cliff, which held out the possibility of caves. They needed shelter, but more important, their protective totem spirits needed a home, if they hadn't already deserted the clan. They were angry. The earthquake proved that. Angry enough to cause the death of six of the clan and destroy their home. If a permanent place for the totemic spirits was not found, they would leave the clan to the mercy of the evil ones that caused illness and chased game away. No one knew why the spirits were angry, not even the witch doctor, though he conducted nightly rituals to appease their wrath and help relieve the clan's anxiety. And in reading these words, my mind began to race back over the centuries and millennia of time, and recall that the universe then, way back then, was a wild and chaotic thing for people. A jungle of warring gods. Gods controlling the winds, gods of rain, gods of fertility, gods of planting, gods of harvest, gods of childbirth, gods of every conceivable aspect of communal and individual life. And these gods often fought among themselves. They loved and hated without reason. They demanded unspeakable bribes. They required meaningless flatteries. And as long as people worshiped such gods as these, any kind of moral law was absolutely impossible. For what pleased one god displeased another. And there was no way the people could win. So they lived out their lives in fear and mortal fear. I had forgotten all about this. I had forgotten my Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. I had forgotten my Greek mythology. Living as I do at the end of the 20th century in a highly sophisticated, scientific, industrialized part of the world and teaching Greek at Wheaton College, the language that is, and Bible at Bethany. And as a consequence, I had forgotten what that first shout from the mountain must have meant to the people living then, living in that kind of a world. To those people who first heard it and believed it, took it in and accepted it. I am the Lord your God, and you shall have no other God besides me, because there is no other God. That shout, a shout so loud that it has echoed through all time, was perhaps the greatest revelatory shout ever made to human beings. It positively slaughtered a host of horrors, evil storm demons, Moloch with his child-eating furnaces, and every other kind of vicious god. There is only one God, not many. There is only one God, and I am that God, said Jehovah, the God of deliverance, not of bondage, the God of salvation, not destruction, the God of redemption, not enslavement, the God of mercy and love and justice, not cruelty and hate and wickedness. I was forced to think again what a word like this would have meant to people living 3 millennia ago. What a liberating word. What a freeing word. But as I only too well know, yesterday's thrilling discovery can all too easily become today's commonplace. It is so possible that some fantastic truth, something with the power to create ecstasy within us, may become, in time, something very unexciting to us. Is it unexciting to us this morning to hear that first word from the mount? I am the Lord your God, creator, deliverer, protector, redeemer. Only one God. And there is no other. May this fantastic truth never become commonplace to us ever. And may we not only hear the negative command, you shall have no other God before me, but may we also hear the unspoken but implicit positive command, you shall have me. And we need to hear it, all parts of it, and all dimensions of it. For still today, all kinds of would-be gods do their best to crowd into our lives and crowd out the one true God. So may once again we hear that shout from the mount. May we hear it deep down in our innermost being, down where we live. I am the Lord your God. I am the Lord your God, and you shall have no other God except me. This is the law of life and happiness and courage. Joy Davidman wrote, whatever we desire, whatever we love, whatever we find worth suffering for, will in the end turn to ashes in our mouths, unless we remember that God comes first. So these great 10 words begin with God, and they continue with God. Listen to these words. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything, in heaven above, or on earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commands. If the first command is a call to order our priorities, to give God first place in our hearts and minds, and to govern all our actions and behavior by this central conviction, then this second command, as I hear it at least, is a warning to us against making any image of God, against consciously or even unconsciously thinking that God is this or God is that. It is a warning against ever imagining that it is possible in any way to limit the illimitable. Man, I had a hard time getting that across. Is that word out? It is a strong reminder that the God who is God, is transcendent, is completely free, is spirit, is invisible, is completely other. And to make an image of God is to try and nail God down. To say in effect, here is God. This is God. Which not only always proves to be an inadequate representation of or a statement about the nature of God, but oftentimes it is wrong, erroneous, besides. The second of the commands, then, is a command to us to let God be God and not to fetter God in any way, not even by our words. For words are images too, nor by our theology. As I was working last night trying to bring this all together, sometimes it is so difficult to do. An interesting and contemporary example of what we're warned against in the second command came to me, sort of a flash of insight. And you may think it's not a flash of insight at all. You may think that it's something very wrong. But nevertheless, that's the way I perceived it, and that's the way I want to talk about it this morning. An interesting and contemporary example of what I hear warned against in the second command. It is that which can be seen in today what is termed the feminist movement. And by the way, as a sort of a parenthesis, I want to go on record as saying, for the most part, I support the feminist movement. Mr. Hess, I appreciate that. And anyone, feel free at any time to disagree and to because we're teachers all in some way, and I don't want to be teaching something that is wrong, even though I may hold it to be true. But look what is happening. I cannot begin to tell you of the number of papers I've heard and articles I've read by intelligent people in an attempt to demonstrate that God is female and that we should use the feminine pronouns she or her when they refer back to God. Obviously, however, this is a reaction to an equally erroneous concept of God that most of us, if not all of us, here in this room, have been guilty of perpetuating all our life long, namely, that God is male, and we must only use the masculine pronoun he or his or him when the pronoun refers back to God. Well, I would like to know what you think about that, but hold on for just a minute. In some sense, both the feminists and we who have stood on the opposite side of the fence are both guilty of breaking or violating a terribly important command. We've been making an image of God, and we've been saying, He is God, or She is God. But neither of us is right. Or, shall I say, neither of us is totally right. For God is neither He nor she. Or, if anything, He is both. But much, much more. Hence, even by our words, we misspeak, and I may be misspeaking this morning. Even by our words, we can create images. But we must remember in all of this that even if we were to take all the adjectives used to describe God that are contained in the Bible, and we've been listing some of these in our Greek class, Pistas Hathaios, God is faithful. Agathas Hathaios, God is good. And even if we were to add all of these adjectives to all the other phrases in the Bible descriptive of God, the God of hope, the God of peace, and so on, and add on top of these all the is statements about God. Agape, hathaios. God is love. God is life. God is light. We must realize that God is more than the sum of these. This total is not God. God is so wonderfully big, so immense, so vast, that no image, whether carved out of stone or thrust onto paper by a computer, can ever begin to describe God. Now I just want to pause and get any kind of reaction that you would like, any response. Okay, I see one hand. Anyhow, Bill? Okay. Yeah. True. Okay, yep. All right, first of all, my intent certainly was not to lay a guilt trip on anyone. But I was making it on both sides. Okay, I poor choice of words. Poor choice. All right. It's not my intent to. That's the first thing I want to say. And the other thing I would like to say is that it's really very interesting in reading that passage in John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. It goes on to say, and the Word was God. And I wish I could open my Greek New Testament for you and point out to you, as I've had the fun of doing to some of my students, the construction that is used there. It's simply the noun God and the noun the Word. And God actually comes first. So if we were reading it like an English-speaking person would read it, we would read, and God was the Word. But it doesn't go that way, even though God comes first. Because the definite article is with the Word, and it's omitted from God. And that's why the Jehovah's Witnesses, for example, will translate it, and the Word was a God. But they don't understand Greek, for one thing. That's why they do it that way. And also they have an axe to grind. And probably, I don't want to say John had an axe to grind, but by inspiration, he did not want to say God was the Word. And why? Because God is more than the Word. The Word was God, yes. In the fullest sense of that expression. But you can't flip the saying around. You cannot say that God was the Word. So even though Jesus was a male, and in a sense we can focus on him and relate to him because he is a person who dwelt among us, yet I think it is wrong for us to get up in arms. Well, here's that word again. Forgive me for laying guilt trips on you. I think we must be careful not to punch somebody in the nose who wants to say God is she. Okay, that's all I want to get across. Oh, okay. Okay, okay. All right. Great. Good start, Bill. Lyndon, please. You're also quoting from an English translation. Oh, well, not really, but go ahead. But I would just like to take that text you and read it in its entirety. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Now, I don't want to get off into any kind of angry, wonderful discussion. I want that. I want to generate your people to think. But what I'm concerned about is the images that we make. And we say that God is this or God is that. That's the point I want to get across. And sometimes the images we make not only restrict our concept of God, but they put us at odds with people, even within the Christian community. And I wouldn't want to be at odds with you, Lyndon, for anything in the world. Okay, at the back, I'm sorry, I've got yet to learn everybody's name. Chris, okay, I should have known that. Chris, would you stand up? Okay, thank you. That's a helpful contribution. Anyone else would like to speak? I haven't heard any women participate. Well, that's not a woman, but Bob, go ahead. Okay, that's good. Stephen, I know he was asking me, but I would rather turn it to Stephen. Okay, Joe?
Wasn't that the most radical thing that these people had? There was no more idols, there was no more statues of a bull or a snake or something, but there was no image, period. There was no altar. It was recognized as an altar in those days. It could be decorated and designed. that was sufficient, because there was this God who was unapproachable to the individual. Unknown to the individual.
And if the Israelites were not always true to this command, I think, and they sort of tucked the images, but they were images from, and maybe that's what Stephen is getting at, where he thinks the command is, "Thou shalt not make any images of any other god," and that may be right. Although it seems to me he cuts the ground out from underneath that in the first commandment. But it is true that even though the Israelites failed in this, I think after the exile, they got rid of all images, so that in their synagogue, you will not see any icons at all. And maybe this is one of the reasons why the Jewish people, who are so creative in music, for example, and in many other ways, are sort of illiterate when it comes to art. I don't know that you can think of very many Jewish artists of great fame, in spite of Chaim Potok's Asher Lev. My name is Asher Lev, but okay. So Stephen, you see it as much broader than what I'm suggesting. As I've pondered it, at least, it seems to me that he's already said, "I am the Lord your God." And therefore, when he said, "Thou shalt not make any graven image," I would understand that to mean not graven images of other gods, but rather images of me, because I am illimitable. Now, it's true, we do have to think in images. Our mind isn't a blank. But I think what it's a warning against is not nailing God down and saying, "This is God. God is like this." Okay, Daniel? Just a little louder so everybody can benefit. Well, to be truthful, well, let me put it in a biographical sketch for you. Even though the tradition in which I have been brought up does not like the term Plymouth Brethren, so you can understand what I'm talking about. That's my roots. I can go back to my father and my mother, and I can go at least back to my grandparents. And they were what you call brethren. And one of the fascinating things to me, and I think Chris probably brought this out, although I didn't get to hear everything he said because I had to take care of the donuts one day. One of the fascinating things about the brethren is that they never developed a creed. The Bible, in a sense, was their creed. And if you ask me about certain creeds today, I have difficulty with them. I'm not talking about the Nicene Creed, but some of the more contemporary creeds, because where do they start? You're a student at Wheaton College, Dan. I know you are. Wheaton College, I don't know if you call it a creed or not, but it has a doctrinal statement. Can you tell me how it begins? Yes, of course. Good. But where do you go from there? Where does it go from there? Which? Okay. Mr. Pollard, how does it begin? here I am making him feel guilty. Bill, forgive me. I don't mean to. Because of all people, I feel guilty for making you feel guilty. David. It starts with, I believe that the Bible is the Word of God or something like that. Where do the Ten Commandments start? With God. Now, I don't want to get into a discussion about that, but Daniel's question was, well, what about creed? God has given us His Word, the Holy Scriptures, which I at least believe is more than just a human book, inspired by the Spirit of God. Now, when creeds started to be made, there were just splits within the church like that. And it's been like that way ever since. I think they're important, and I want to rule them out. But at the same time, I don't like them. I'm on the horns of a dilemma. Okay. Just loud enough. That is correct.
And so, regardless whether we approve of feminism or not, there is a tremendous emphasis
of
self.
Oh, you mean in the whole debate?
Yes.
Oh, yes. And I agree with that. Okay. There isn't value in. I think of, let me just go on record. I think it is important for me to not say God is He and stand on that. You see. And I think it's important for you, Grace Lee, you feminist, you, to stand on this side. And say, God is she. No, I know, I'm just joking. And I shouldn't joke, but... you see, I want to stand in the middle and put my arms around both. Because both are right. But both are wrong in their exclusivity. That's what. Okay, thank you very much, Dan.
Yeah, the only thing they do is the Hebrews would accept a God who didn't come down in physical form. The Greeks, the Romans, and the others said God had come down and created their own little dynasties and whatnot. But it was a God who didn't have sex. respect for above humanness. You know, it's all about humanness that humans couldn't comprehend it, but then here's some other people that they love the people. But he or she or what it all was like. So it's not too difficult to think, but I think you brought up where you always hear he is, you have a concept of he. And the Christians felt that right away when they had that image, when they had a focus on the heathen, and when they excluded women that they you know, inferior, so that was carry on. But again, the Hebrews never said he had male organs, that he come down, he was a dynasty, but for other doctrine, he would do that. It was God that had nothing to do with humans in that sense, in a physical sense. He had no need, you know, in that sense.
Okay, so, Thanks very much, Joe. Did I take one more hand and that one? Okay, Paul.
There may be a whole different complexity in thinking of what Jesus was like when he's in the business of putting illustrations, Bible story books, and Bibles and everything. I have a Bible here that shows that Jesus had long hair. Obviously, we know he had blonde hair, and this is sort of red hair. He's blonde hair and blue eyes. We know that, except my black brother said, hey, your God is too. You know, that I don't think God has blind hair, Jesus has blind hair. And it becomes a real question for us and how do you picture Jesus? And I think one of the wonders that God did was that Jesus was a medic. And probably in between the black and the white, so we really don't know. I think that as we individuals look at pictures, the illustrations of Jesus, we tend to believe that Jesus is like us. And yet I appreciate your emphasis in saying that we don't know what Jesus looks like exactly. And no man has seen the Father except
thank you. Thank you very much, Paul. Now, we've got to quit because it's time. What I try to do is think of some illustration by which we can grasp concrete ideas, abstract ideas, and make them concrete. So if I use the wrong one and I offended anybody, may I just apologize for that. But I would like us all to be thinking, and thinking biblically, if we possibly can. What is God? Who is God? Well, he is above description, and that makes me want to fall down and worship him this morning.